You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, as African American History Month comes to a close, we'll talk about the early history of African Americans and the Great Migration in Beloit. First, state lawmakers made it easier last year for homeless youth to find a place to stay in Wisconsin. But advocates say there's still a lot more that needs to be done for young people without shelter. In a new piece from Wisconsin Watch and the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service, our next guest says even the size of the problem may be much bigger than we know. Jim Malowitz is the investigations editor at Wisconsin Watch. He edited their latest story, Nowhere to Go, Why Wisconsin's Homeless Youth Go Uncounted and Underserved. Jim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Let's go with this uncounted part of the story here first. The state has an idea, we think, of how many homeless unaccompanied teens there are in the state. From this reporting, it sounds like we don't really have those numbers.
Right. It's really hard to know. The state estimates overall for its total population, not just youth, that there's about 22,000 people statewide who have received services from shelters and other temporary living facilities. And only about 500 of them are unaccompanied youth. But that probably vastly undercounts how many youth don't have a stable place to go. That's just how many are served. And in Milwaukee alone, the Milwaukee Public School District is serving something along the lines of 5,000 youth who don't have a stable living situation.
Talk about some of the stories that might have a young person homeless and, you know, scrounging for a place to stay, but not either not seeking those services or not being eligible to receive services.
Sure. So our reporters, Francisco Velasquez and Princess Safia Byers of Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service, they followed the story of Diana Sanchez, who was in Milwaukee in her final year of high school. She lives now in New Jersey. But she had a situation where she was basically hopping couches among her extended family at first, going from her aunt's place to her uncle's place and sort of feeling unwelcome there, and then having to look for friends to house her temporarily for about her whole senior year at an alternative school. And so she recalls trying to stay at school later than she was welcome there, and having a police call to escort her out of the building at times when she was waiting for one of these couches to open up. So she recalls it being a really tough time for her to be able to focus on school in her final year of high school. And she even did look for shelter from a homeless shelter from other programs, but was often found that these programs served kind of different segments of youth that she wasn't a part of, whether it was someone who was pregnant, which she wasn't, or someone who had been in trouble with the law, which she wasn't. So she really found nowhere stable to go.
One of the saddest things shared in the story is that in some cases, teens who are homeless would actually try to get in trouble with the law to have a place to stay. Do I have that right?
Right. That's what some of the youth advocates in Milwaukee were telling our reporters, that they were so desperate that they would figure that was maybe the most stable thing to do, was once you get in trouble with the law, then you're in the criminal system, the juvenile justice system, but at least then you're directed somewhere to go.
There have been changes in state law. There's a big task force over the last couple of years looking at homelessness. What kind of changes came out of that might be at least partly relevant to homeless teens?
Right. So Governor Walker in 2017 convened a task force on homelessness in general. One of the recommendations that came out of that task force and is now law is Act 22, which is a law that Governor Evers signed just this last year, that allows unaccompanied 17-year-olds to check into homeless shelters or these transitional living facilities that try to arrange longer-term housing for youth, check into them without parental supervision. Because before, a teen without a parent couldn't just sign themselves in. So that law targets only 17-year-olds. So it's a very small segment of that population. But advocates are saying that's a start to eliminate some of the barriers, but it still depends upon which teens are aware of the options and actually identifying themselves as homeless.
Now, as we mentioned, some teens might actually use the status of being in trouble with the law in the hopes of getting a place to stay. Other people your reporters talked to found that some teens didn't want to reach out for help because they didn't want to get caught up in the social service system or the criminal justice system.
Exactly. These teens might just not want to draw attention to themselves, whether it's at school or someone else, in fear of just being part of that overall system. And once you're a part of the criminal justice system, it's often hard to get out, even if you commit a minor offense. There's a 2014 state report that showed that about a third of youth who offend initially will reoffend in the coming year.
Talking to Jim Malowitz, investigations editor at Wisconsin Watch. A new piece from Wisconsin Watch and the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service looks at teens who are homeless, finds they are undercounted in the state and have trouble accessing services they might need. Jim, a lot of the focus of this reporting is in Milwaukee, but this is not just a Milwaukee story in Wisconsin, is it?
It's not. You know, the focus here was Milwaukee because we partnered with a Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service, and of course it's the biggest city in Wisconsin, but it is a statewide issue. There are thousands more beyond Milwaukee of homeless youth that are likely struggling to get services.
Now, there's one effort in La Crosse trying to provide host homes for people who are homeless. And I think other places than La Crosse, but this is one your team had focused on. What is that?
Right. So the Host Homes program is managed by a nonprofit in La Crosse that basically finds volunteers within the community to host homeless teens. And it might sound a little bit like a foster care program, but it's different in that in the foster system, these are teens who are sort of already entered into the system and don't really have a choice as to where they go. In this case, the teens themselves, the youth, are also volunteering to come find a home. So it's the type of program that Diana Sanchez, the teen, now adult, who we talked to for the story, said that she would have liked to have something like that in Milwaukee, where she was looking for somewhere to go. In La Crosse, there at least is this one program that to serve that community's homeless youth.
When it comes to the scope of the problem, how many teens are dealing with homelessness who, again, aren't counted, is somebody trying to count? Is somebody trying to get a better sense, apart from this kind of reporting, trying to get a better official sense of how many teens are out there?
That's a good question. I mean, I think it, again, depends on, like, what the definition is. So there are various groups that serve the homeless, like shelters, that are, they're all plugged into sort of one network where they record how many people that they serve. And also school systems do tend to record how many youth they serve with services that they have to offer. But I'm not sure beyond that, beyond sort of those individual groups, whether there's any even broader effort to count. It's just really hard to get a sense of it.
On the service side, you mentioned that, you know, there might be a program for pregnant teens, for people who have had trouble with the law. But a lot of people would fall through the cracks because they don't fit those categories. Is there an effort out there to fill those gaps?
Definitely. And so in the homelessness task force that Governor Walker had put together, there were a lot of recommendations aimed at helping fill those gaps. And one of them is kind of along the lines of the Host Homes program we talked about, a broader effort in what's called transitional living, which isn't just the day-to-day, night-to-night shelter living, but these programs that will provide services to teens that they're that enroll in them, and then try to get them longer-term living.
It seems, reading the story of Diana Sanchez, I mean, she has a unique story in many ways with her family, her mom being out of the state, a lot going into this. It seems like it might be hard to come up with a one-size-fits-all approach because every one of these homeless teens in the statistic, whatever the number is, has their own unique story, too.
Definitely. And I think it kind of gets at the chronic nature of homelessness in some sense, that it's probably a lot easier to address some of the broader social problems that are leading teens to be homeless, rather than having to then react once and sort of catch that population once they do lose homes and lose that stability. So there's probably a lot, like, much more broader efforts that could be done.
And finally, Diana Sanchez was kind of the center of this story. Where you mentioned she's in New Jersey now. What do we know about how she came through that senior year, basically couch to couch?
Right. So there is a nice little ending. She says she's not in the most stable position right now, but she is living with her mother, who had been living in New Jersey also while Diana was in high school. So she, now that she's an adult, she said that her mother is able to kind of live alongside her. And it was just in the past, her mom didn't feel like, she said that she had the ability to raise what had been a teenager. Now that she's 19, she does have a job in New Jersey at Fila, the clothing company. And so she has a roof over her head that's a little bit more stable.
Jim, thanks a lot for sharing this with us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Jim Malowitz, investigations editor at Wisconsin Watch. He was with us today to talk about their latest story, Nowhere to Go, Why Wisconsin's Homeless Youth Go Uncounted and Underserved. You can find a link to that story at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up, our guest is working to bring attention to the history of African Americans in Wisconsin. We'll hear the story of the Great Migration Era in Beloit. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, the Democratic contenders for the White House took to the debate stage again last night, this time in South Carolina, ahead of that state's primary. We'll talk about that and other top stories in our weekly look at national politics. First, African American History Month wraps up this week, but how much do you know about the history of Black Americans here in Wisconsin? Our next guest is working to spread the stories of some of the first African Americans to move to one city in the state during the Great Migration, Beloit. Linda Fair is an academic advisor at Black Hawk Technical College in Janesville. She talked to WPR host Keely Boltina yesterday about her research.
Help us understand, when we start to see African Americans migrating to Beloit, what's driving that migration?
What drove the migration mainly was African Americans migrating from the South, and one of the main reasons was a company here in Beloit, which is still there, Fairbanks and Morris, were looking for extra help right during the time of the war. Their production level was high, and their bodies of employees were low, so they sought out ways that they can increase their workforce, and a gentleman that worked there as a custodian felt he had an in connection with some people from the South, because that's where his family was from, and they were looking, you know, for more success, more ways to be prosperous, and more adventures. So that's how he recruited for them to come up here and, you know, bring their families up.
What did Fairbanks, Morse and Company make during the war?
They are a Fairbanks Morse & Company, and they still are. They were doing some of the naval engines and industrial equipment of that nature.
Okay. And so people realized, African Americans specifically realized, this might be a place where I can work. And the company realized, hey, this is an untapped resource for workers. If we can get them up here, we can do what we do better, faster.
Exactly. More. Yes, exactly. And again, at this time, they were thinking of ways, too, that they can become successful and do more, you know, want to bring their families up to a different type of environment where they might not experience as much racial tension, and, again, be able to work and provide for their families and send back for some of their other family members.
We'll talk a little more about what drew African Americans to Beloit and how that changed the city. But is that what happened when these families thought, maybe we can escape some of the bad things of our lives here in the South? Did it change for them when they came to Wisconsin?
Yes and no. To the degree they were able to make money, but they still faced some different racial tension. They found out soon that just because Wisconsin was in the North, all the people that lived here were not as accepting of integrating communities and seeing them in the workforce. They still felt a little segregated into themselves. And even though they were in the bigger community, they had their own community within a community, if you know what I mean. That's when Fairbanks Morse helped incorporate places for them to live, helped incorporate places for them to worship and fellowship. fellowship because they used the church as a social center, and then they were able to they built what was called Edgewater YMCA and brought up someone from the South to be the superintendent of that location, just so they did feel that they had some type of outlet, but nevertheless, they still felt segregated.
Which, in hindsight, is not overly surprising today, because what's the time frame we're talking about here? This was very real. Segregation was very real. And this was well before we even saw things happening in the 60s with the civil rights movement.
Exactly, yes. We're talking, basically, the Great Migration was from around 1915 up until about 1970.
All right. And what was it like in Beloit for that first wave of African Americans who came up? You said the company really helped, but what did they experience when they got here?
Again, they found themselves having not enough space to live. Again, like I mentioned earlier, with a places to worship, because they were heavy into their faith, and just finding jobs for other family members. So that was some of the stuff that they faced, too, once they got here.
And what then was their standard of living when they first came to Wisconsin? Did it differ dramatically from their experiences in the South?
I would say probably a combination. It was a little bit of the same. Again, like I mentioned, they were found themselves segregated, staying in one certain area. Fairbanks was nice enough to build and accommodate them. They created some row houses, which are still in existence in Beloit, called the Fairbanks Flats, and that's where the majority of them stayed. And so they were able to really build a community, like I said, within a community, and they majority of the workers stayed there. So now families who aren't related by blood, but now they are becoming one big family, and they're working together, they're eating together and socializing and just hanging with each other, just to kind of for that comfort and protection.
Linda Fair is an academic advisor at Black Hawk Technical College in Janesville, and we're talking about her research into the early history of African Americans in Beloit, Wisconsin. And Linda, this is part of your own family's story.
Yes, it is. My family, my mom was part of the Great Migration. My grandfather came up, him and his brothers, to work in one of the other local foundries around Beloit, which was known then as Iron Works, and then it changed the name to Beloit Corporation. So he came up, and he worked there for close to 50 years, and they came in the mid-1930s. Again, just taking a chance, word traveled that there's room for growth and opportunity in this city. So they just took a chance and came up. And then his brothers came also, and they all lived under one roof. My mom and her siblings, along with which would have been their aunts and uncles, they all just stayed under one roof together.
And this is something
coming from Houston, Mississippi, yes.
When you think about the stories that your family has told, does that seem to fit with the experiences that you've researched that other families had?
Yes, it does. Where my grandmother was a domestic in the home, she and like my aunts, they stayed and tend to the children, could clean and that type of housework around the house and home, while the guys and the gentlemen went out and worked in the foundries like Fairbanks Morris. I had an uncle there, and then also, like I said, Iron Works. So they were doing the work, the manual labor, while the women stayed home. And most of the people I've talked to, that's how it was. It was the gentlemen, the men going out into the workforce, actually working, and the ladies were home tending to the children and tending to meals and tending to the home.
This moment in history changed the makeup of the city of Beloit. It changed the racial proportions here. We saw a lot more African Americans coming to Beloit. When is it that they go from feeling like outsiders to people in the African community, like seeing an opportunity to be part of the community, to serve?
It was well until almost like the 40s and 50s, after they finally started feeling like we can make our name here, we can be comfortable here, and they started opening up their own businesses, from barbershops to restaurants, even running hotels such as the Dewdrop Inn, things of that nature. They started feeling a little more empowered and taking a chance, and it was working for them at that time.
And what is the status then that we see today? Are these tensions the same, or is this a place where you hear from the African community that they feel is part theirs?
I hate to say it, at this time, they still don't quite feel as much ownership for the community. Beloit has a 15% makeup of African-Americans in their community at the time, and we still struggle, and I'm saying we because I'm an African-American female, we still struggle with being recognized and able to move up in corporate worlds, still have to face like some prejudices and racism with different roles and jobs and sections of the city where we live. And it's almost like history repeating itself, that we're regressing some, although there are other opportunities where some African-Americans are really shining and setting the stage for our younger generation to know how hard it was and to remove some of the barriers. So it's better, but there's room for improvement.
And how do we make sure that people know these stories so that the bad of history doesn't repeat itself?
Again, similar to what I do, I started 4 years ago with just doing Beloit Black History Moments through my Facebook page, just as a personal gift that I thought I should do for our younger people, because I was always around my mom, them, and other people, and listening and just like a sponge absorbing all of the information. So I feel that I can't just hold on to this information. I need to spread the word, and times have changed. Social media is that vehicle now where you could get the information out, and that's one of the things that I've, taken on, just really trying to spread the word. And if nothing else, to encourage and empower our younger generation that you can do and become whatever you want. Things are different, but yet a little bit of the same. But you can still go forward and try. If they made it through some of these hardships, you should be able to do what you want to do and be it whatever you can be at this time.
Linda, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
That was Linda Fair with Black Hawk Technical College talking to WPR host Keely Boltina about the early history of African Americans in Beloit. You can find a write-up of a talk Linda gave and a video of the talk itself at wiscontext.org. Coming up after the news, we'll check in on the latest political news out of Washington and on the campaign trail. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Brexit officially happened last month, and that opens the door to a change in the trading relationship between the U.S. and the U.K. Republican U.S. Representative Mike Gallagher joins the show to share his hopes for a new trade deal. First, it's time for our weekly check-in on national politics. Coronavirus, also known as COVID-19, is getting attention from the president and Congress. And as the election season kicks into high gear, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell introduced two abortion-related bills that were quickly blocked by Democrats. Last night, Democratic presidential hopefuls met in another debate with the South Carolina primary coming up. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you been following last night's debate, all the debates so far? What is striking you? What are you watching for this Saturday and then coming up on Super Tuesday? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@WPR.org. Lauren Gambino joins us now, political correspondent for The Guardian. Lauren, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's start with the Democratic debate last night. A chaotic, sort of raucous scene. What did you take away?
Yes, there was a lot of chaos, a lot of talking over each other. I think that was the takeaway this morning. I don't know if you were undecided in South Carolina. I'm not sure if last night's debate helped you. It was really hard. I think there was a clear decision to go after Senator Bernie Sanders, who came out of Nevada in a very strong position. He's clearly now the party's front runner for the nomination. But, you know, in the midst of all these attacks on him, they were sort of attacking each other as well. And it turned out to be just a bit of a melee that we haven't seen quite like that before.
Do we learn much new on the policy front? Are we getting new stuff out of these debates or just new lines of attack for one character or one candidate to another?
Well, it seems like last night was the 10th debate, and it was the 10th time we'd heard them really go after each other on the different their different healthcare proposals. So it does at times feel like we're just repeating the same policy debates without, but you know, new lines of attack. But I would say, you know, Senator Sanders, especially around foreign policy, there were some new attacks. You know, Senator Sanders has been sort of in the past few days commented on Fidel Castro and, saying that while he's an authoritarian, while he was an authoritarian leader, he also did, you know, good things for the country. And that's, you know, inspired some real backlash, which we saw come up in the context of foreign policy, but also certainly the candidates just wanting to take some jabs at Sanders. And they compared him to Donald Trump's the way Donald Trump flatters some authoritarian leaders. And, Sanders fought back, but I think that maybe that was the newest sort of line that seemed to really break through and stick, I think.
Let's give a listen to Senator Sanders responding to some of those critiques.
I have opposed authoritarianism all over the world. What I said is what Barack Obama said in terms of Cuba, that Cuba made progress on education. Yes, I think, really? Really?
Yes, literacy
programs
no
are bad. What Barack Obama said is they made great progress on education and health care.
Some of the crosstalk you were talking about earlier there, along with former Mayor Pete Buttigieg. So there's been a lot of focus on Senator Sanders, and now the next test comes up in South Carolina. What are people watching for there?
So South Carolina has been billed as Joe Biden's firewall. He doesn't want to say that, but that is the case. And Joe Biden really needs to do well there. For many months now, he's talked about his electability, and that is based on his strength with black voters. This is the first primary where black voters are going to play a very significant role. They're more than a majority of the Democratic electorate in the state. And so Joe Biden really needs to show after falling behind Bernie Sanders now in three consecutive contests, he needs to show that he can not only beat Bernie Sanders, but do it fairly soundly and really, really come out with a strong showing among black voters who vote in strong numbers for Democrats. So I think everyone's watching how Joe Biden comes out. Bernie Sanders has made a really concerted effort to catch up to Joe Biden in the state. He was blown out of the water by Hillary Clinton in 2016. So if he's able to really compete with Biden, I think that's a sign of how much he's improved over these past 4 years. And then, of course, the person who actually won't be on the ballot, but everyone's watching, is Michael Bloomberg. He's not going to appear on the ballot until Super Tuesday, but his spending and he's sort of this shadow over the field right now, and it's unclear. It's really unclear how he'll factor in just a few days later on Super Tuesday.
It's our weekly look at the latest in national politics. Lauren Gambino is with us from The Guardian. You can join in on the Democratic primary field, the debates, the voting coming up in South Carolina, what just happened in Nevada, who you like, who you're wondering about, what you think about the tone of the debate. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Staying in South Carolina, Joe Biden, former Vice President Joe Biden, got a big endorsement from a key Democratic figure there, House Majority Whip James Clyburn. People have been wondering if and when he'd endorse someone. Here's a listen to him.
As I stand before you today, I am fearful for the future of this country. I'm fearful for my daughters and their futures and their children and their children's future. This country is at an inflection point. It is time for us to restore this country's dignity, this country's respect. That is what is at stake this year.
And he went on to make the case that Biden was the best Democratic candidate to take up that challenge. How big a deal is this for voters in South Carolina?
I think it's a really big deal, especially as we talked about at the top. You know, last night's debate didn't really help clarify the race, and a respected, influential figure like James Clyburn endorsing Joe Biden is kind of the energy that he really needs around his campaign. Polling shows, and anecdotally, a lot of voters in South Carolina have said they haven't made up their mind, and so they are and could very possibly be looking to someone like James Clyburn to weigh in and help clarify the race for them. A lot of voters there say their top priority is to beat Donald Trump. It's not policy. It's not, ideology. It is beating Donald Trump. And there is a sense of urgency around that, especially in the Black community, which has such which carries a lot of weight in this primary. So I think it was very important.
That's looking forward to South Carolina. Let's look back at Nevada a bit. You wrote about this, the significance of Bernie Sanders pulling off a win in Nevada. What's the significance there?
I think that was significant because he'd, effectively came very close with Pete Buttigieg in Iowa. It was closer than expected, but he did win in New Hampshire. Nevada, there was no qualifiers. He won it outright. It was a big night for him, and when you actually dug into the data of who turned out for him, Latinos came out in a really big number, and Latino voters will play a very important role on Super Tuesday in states like California, Texas, later Arizona. So Latinos, that he did so well with Latinos in Nevada is a good sign for him, down the road and how he might perform in California, these big delegate states. And obviously in the primary, the goal is to get as many delegates as possible. So I think, it was sort of a moral victory. These early states are not about collecting delegates. It's all about momentum. And that certainly gave him a lot of momentum. But there were also signs in that victory of how he might do later on. And I think that's where you really saw a lot of establishment and more moderate Democrats start to get really nervous, because they realize if he really gets on a roll and does really well in some of these Super Tuesday states, it's going to be very hard to catch Bernie Sanders. And many Democrats are worried about a Sanders nomination.
Now, how about the rest of the candidates? Where are they putting their hopes on Super Tuesday, which is just around the corner? And as you say, we're going to see a lot more delegates popping up then.
Yeah, you see them sort of all spread out differently. There's more than a dozen states that go. Obviously, California is very important. That's the most delegates of any one single state. So, they have tried to invest there, but it does look like Sanders and then Michael Bloomberg with his many millions of dollars is kind of leading the ground game, if you will, or the TV game, because it's California. But then, Joe Biden's made a concerted effort in a lot of southern states that will vote. He, again, wants to show his strength with Black voters. Amy Klobuchar is Minnesota. That's where she'd like to really prove that she can win there. And then, Elizabeth Warren in Massachusetts will vote, and she's in a tight race there with Bernie Sanders. It would obviously be a moral blow to lose your home state. So the candidates are really spread out across the map, and it's sort of just where you think you can gain the most delegates. You're going to spend these final precious days in those states trying to do the best, because you've got to break a 15% threshold to get any delegates. So you do have to have some sort of a presence. You can't just sort of pop up at the last minute.
Talking to Lauren Gambino, political correspondent for The Guardian, with us to talk about the latest in national politics and the presidential race. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on the Democratic primary contest so far, or your questions, 800-642-1234. Also check out a couple non-election issues that's coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our weekly check-in on national politics. Lauren Gambino is with us, political correspondent for The Guardian. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have thoughts on the debate last night, the primary in South Carolina, Super Tuesday coming up, who should drop out, who should stay in, whether you're supporting Democrats or not, who do you want to see running? Call 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Marcus is with us in Madison. Marcus, hi.
Hi, Ms. Gambino, I wonder if you could respond to this, please. I'd like to just briefly point up the corrupt nature of these corporate fake debates. For instance, the clip you played was not crosstalk. It was Mayor Pete Bott interrupting what Sanders was saying, which he did all night long. Also, it cost over $1,700 for a seat at this so-called debate. And so you heard basically no response from the audience to anything Bernie Sanders said, because none of his constituents are likely to have the dough to spend over $1,700 for a seat. So the entire thing seems to be an event sponsored by the DNC in order to downplay Sanders and artificially prop up the other candidates who so far haven't been in it at all.
Marcus, thanks for the call. Lauren, there's been criticism over the admission fee, for one thing, as Marcus was saying, and people have said that has stacked the deck in the audience against Sanders. What's been the talk on that?
Yeah, you've heard a lot about that. And you could hear, you know, Sanders, he wasn't just deflecting criticism from the other candidates. It was also from the audience, and that was part of it. You know, you got the sense, listening to how the audience reacted, that there were a lot of supporters of the mayor, Pete Buttigieg, and also of the former mayor, Michael Bloomberg, in the audience. That's who they seemed to react to the most. And, you know, Sanders said afterwards, he too criticized the price and said, that's not my supporters, and that's why you didn't hear them. I think, you know, it also gave Sanders sort of another point of contrast. He was able to interact with the audience in a way that, you know, sort of fit his brand. So he seemed to lean into this. But certainly this morning, there's been a lot of discussion about why it is so expensive to attend these, and if it's fair, and if it's, you know, small D Democratic, you know, shouldn't these be open to voters and people who will actually be making the decisions and not just those who can afford these very expensive tickets?
Let's bring on another caller before we move on from the debates and the race. Ann is with us in Bayview. Ann, hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. It's a question that I have in terms of managing what the audience can hear, and it's candidates talking over each other that was mentioned earlier. Isn't there a way they can just turn off the mics when time is hit so that after minute 15, a candidate has his say or her say, mic is off, someone else has the opportunity to speak? I'm wondering if others feel the same way I do, or if you have any understanding of technology that...
And thanks for the call. There's been criticism, Lauren. I don't know about exactly how they had the mics set up there, but there's been criticism over how the debate was managed and letting the candidates get out of control, talk too long, and talk over each other.
I will say that's not the first time I've gotten that question. Why can't they just cut the mics? And I don't know why they do. I think that might be a bit abrupt for the audience to keep just cutting them off, because sometimes it is nice to hear the end of a thought. But last night, I think, was I hate to say worse than we've seen before, but they really didn't jump in ways that we've seen other moderators handle these debates. That last night seems to be an exception, and it just got out of hand. I think that also, though, speaks to the tension among these candidates. They are, you know, many of them, this could be their last debate. There's not another debate until after Super Tuesday, and it's unclear that any of them will have this big national platform again, and they were clearly trying to get every word in edgewise and, you know, take every shot at their opponents to really stand out. You know, whether that was the effect, I guess we'll find out. But certainly you could feel the tension, and that was part of it.
And thanks for that call. We were looking at some of the top stories in national politics. Lauren Gambino is with us from The Guardian. Let's move off the campaign trail. Capitol Hill, Mitch McConnell, Senate Majority Leader, introduced brought to a vote a couple of abortion bills, procedural votes. What is in this proposed legislation?
So it should be said, neither of these bills passed, but they focused on when you can have an abortion. So the first one was about banning abortions after 20 weeks. And then another one was about what happens when a baby is born after an abortion. And it gets at the heart of these culture wars. Those who support abortion rights say these bills are unnecessary, especially the one about how doctors respond in these very rare situations when the result is that a baby is born rather than being aborted. They say, doctors take an oath to do no harm. They would, of course, they already have to care for the baby when it's born. So this law is unnecessary. They think it's meant to divide the caucus and make Democrats take these very difficult votes. I think more broadly, it speaks to an issue that we're seeing increasingly. Democrats used to be a bit more nuanced on abortion. We saw that with Joe Biden. He for a long time, he's Catholic, and he's had more of a nuanced view on this issue. And since joining the race, he's, kind of adopted more of a progressive line on this. So increasingly, the Democratic Party is more far to the left on abortion. And Republicans really think that this is an issue that they can hit Democrats with in 2020. They think they really do believe culture wars will be a winning strategy for Donald Trump, especially when he's trying to attract evangelical voters and voters who are really moved to vote on the issue of abortion. So that is why we saw it come up yesterday.
And then one of the big news stories out there, the novel coronavirus or COVID-19, we're watching it flare up around the world. And what are we seeing when it comes to reaction from the White House and from Congress?
You're seeing a really interesting reaction from Congress. It's bipartisan. They are very... They're kind of alarmed, and there's a lot of backlash coming from Capitol Hill over the White House's handling of the response to the coronavirus, especially after we heard from the CDC that it's sort of a matter of when and not if, there's an outbreak in the U.S. So, the CDC warned this week that they are very much preparing for cases here, and, the White House has been roundly criticized by members of both parties for not stepping up to the challenge. We saw even Republicans go after members of the administration in a hearing over how much funding the White House has requested. They said it was far too small to actually deal with what's being expected. The White House requested $2.5 billion, and Democrats and Republicans have both said that's not enough. So, if Republicans are on board for more money from the government, it's serious. And so I think this is something to watch. Obviously, Donald Trump does not want to look like the administration got caught off guard, especially in a year where he's running for re-election. So I think, we'll hear him speak about it, and I think it's going to be very interesting to see how forcefully they respond to this after this criticism this week.
And a lot of the president's messaging is focused on not overinflating fears, he says, and bringing up concerns over how this could affect the stock market, which dropped a lot the first couple of days this week. So this the economic impact of this is a worry for the president and his team, potentially.
Absolutely, because part of his message to, his reelection message is look at the economy, look how great it is, and it's, how great it's become under my 3 to 4 years in the White House, and imagine what could happen with 4 more years. So if the stock market starts to take a tumble and, we start to actually see more of an impact, then I think that really undercuts that messaging. And it's a risk that the White House really doesn't want to take right now. So I certainly think, yes, he's trying to calm fears. Because the White House's messaging is so out of step with what we heard from the CDC yesterday and what we're hearing from members of Congress, I think at some point they're going to have to address this concern that we're hearing from his own administration and Republican lawmakers as well.
Lauren, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
I've been talking to Lauren Gambino, political correspondent for The Guardian. She joins us today for a weekly roundup of national politics, the latest news from Washington, D.C., and on the campaign trail. Still time for you to weigh in. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. Let us know your reaction to the debate last night, the candidates themselves, the format, the raucous nature, pro or con. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. Are you looking for something that will help put your next presentation over the top? Maybe you're doing a PowerPoint for your work or a school project for your school, a flyer for a community group or a birthday party invitation. As of this week, there's a new archive of 2.8 million images and other stuff available for free from the Smithsonian Institution. America's Attic has combed through its digital archives and found lots and lots of stuff to share with us in their new Open Access project. I took it for a test drive and did some searches. You want dinosaur? They've got dinosaur. Over 1,000 images from fossilized bones to fossilized bones and more fossilized bones. Plus, there are some full-on skeletons that look pretty cool. You want James Garfield, 20th president of the United States? They've got photos, caricatures, blocks of postage stamps, even a sculpture that you can rotate in 3D. Pop culture, they've got. How about a picture of some platform ankle boots worn by rock funk legend Bootsy Collins? And they've got stuff closer to home, too. Mineral samples from Colby, Wisconsin. A landscape painting of Milwaukee in 1858. Botanical images from Door County. They've got it all. All this stuff, but what do you do with it? Well, the Smithsonian has some suggestions in a new downloadable booklet, How to Make a Collagosaurus. So we're going to, I think, be done with the show today and just have fun making collages, right? I can do that? No? No? Okay, there's more Central Time to come. We'll hold off on the collages till later. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.